So welcome back. I hope you had a good break during the lunch period. And I'm going to now address the theme of our day, which I've titled the Four Noble Tasks. And for those of you who have heard me speak before or read some of my more recent writing, will know that this is the way in which I'm trying to understand the classical Buddhist doctrine of the Four Noble Truths. But let's begin by considering something that won't, perhaps at first sight, seem to have much to do with this at all, and that is taking photographs. This is something that I probably would have ended up doing professionally had I not been diverted by Buddhism. when I left the grammar school in Watford, I had a place at what was then the Regent Street Polytechnic, which now the University of something or other, and I was going to do a 3-year training in professional photography, which had been something actually that had been part of my family background. My grandfather was a photo engraver in Covent Garden. My great uncle was one of the pioneers in colour photography in the United States. And from a young age, I was passionately involved in photography, both taking photos and developing them. Then I went off to India and got involved in the study and practice of Buddhism, and all of the other plans went to pot. And in fact, I sometimes think of it that I'm still on my gap year. But nonetheless, even during the gap year, I have spent periods of time coming back to the practice of photography. So let's just look at, in a very sort of simple and straightforward way that I think all of us can understand, what it is to take a photograph. Just to step back and analyse that process. Well, of course, the first thing one does is one opens one's eyes to what is in front of you. You may have some idea of the kind of image you are looking for, but you can't even start without paying attention. In a somewhat more than habitual way to what you're seeing. In other words, you look more carefully. And I found that very much as I was doing both meditation practice and the practice of photography, that the way that I attuned myself to looking with the eyes through the viewfinder on what was before me was a very similar subjective state to how I would set up myself to begin a session of meditation. It was a similar kind of looking. It wasn't looking for something currently invisible, looking for something behind what's apparent, but learning to look more closely at what's actually going on here and now in the immediate visual field. But the problem very often is that what we find ourselves looking for in a photograph is very often a kind of idealized image of what is present, rather than looking afresh at what is actually there. And this is true, I think, in most of the arts, is that one's always somehow influenced by the work of those artists, photographers that you admire. And this is the problem that Harold Bloom calls the anxiety of influence. That unless we're taking photographs purely for a record of something, if we're seeking to produce a photograph that aspires to the condition of art, which I do, then we become very aware of how so often what we are looking for is a kind of a cliched version of Henri Cartier-Bresson or some other great photographer whose work has been of great influence to us. And that gets in the way too. It gets very much in the way. That our work becomes basically trying to live up to some ideal, trying to match some image that we greatly admire. And it takes an awful lot of work, actually, to break free from those kinds of influences in order to be able to see the world afresh. But again, it's not quite as simple as that. It's not as though we self-consciously put aside our favourite or ideal images, but we come to be able to put them aside by gaining a fresh view of what we're seeing right now. And so the two go hand in hand. There's a close paying of attention to what we see in the viewfinder, and at the same time, a longing almost, an aspiration to go beyond a cliched image. And at a certain point, you press the shutter. In other words, you stop whatever was going on in the viewfinder, the movement, your particular bodily relation to what is being looked at, and there comes what Cartier-Bresson calls the decisive moment, at which you press the shutter, and that moment then gives birth to an image. And for myself, if that image is to be at all satisfying, it has to somehow be an image that reveals the world in a new way, in a way that's not quite been represented or seen in that manner before. And so great photographers are able, as it were, to show us the world from a new point of view, from a new perspective, one that we may not have really had any inclination of before. And I think this is true, broadly speaking, of the arts in general, whether it be writing or painting or sculpture or dance or poetry. I think what is perhaps most thrilling for the artist and perhaps most engaging and perhaps shocking for the viewer is that the world appears in a new way. The world appears, or is shown to us in an unexpected shape or form or image. And the practice of photography, therefore, is very much a practice of learning to go beyond preconceived ideas, fixed ideas, and through the power of observation itself, and also, of course, through having a certain technical mastery of the instrument that you're using, the camera, reaches a moment of illumination, you might say, a moment of insight, a moment of stopping, in which the shutter is pressed and the world is then captured. For that moment is captured in such a way that it can become available to others. It becomes part of the public domain. You print the photograph, nowadays you email it. And another way of seeing the world has come into being. You've brought something into being, you've created something that reveals life from another perspective. Now that's perhaps a rather idealized way of describing the process of, let's say, art photography. What one notices, or at least I notice, is how photographs are often, or photography is often used, as really a way of trying to capture an idealized image of something. And to give an example of that, if you're standing on the seashore and there's a beautiful dramatic sunset, everybody will whip out their camera and start snapping away. Now, I would argue that what they are trying to capture here is some idealized image of a beautiful sunset. Or if you go to a place like Notre Dame in Paris, you'll find standing in front of it lots of people with often extremely expensive equipment that I could never afford, taking snapshots and images of Notre Dame. But frankly, they would be much better off just going inside and buying a postcard. It would be much less expensive, and the image would be much better. And it's often the experience people have that the photograph, when it is developed, or nowadays when you look at it on the back of the screen, somehow fails to capture at all what it is that was so breathtakingly beautiful in real life. Often the photograph feels profoundly diminished, just a kind of a yet another photograph of a sunset, yet another photograph of Notre Dame. Nothing has been achieved. In fact, all that we have brought into the world is an image that is inferior to that which we'd find on most postcards. Now, of course, there are other elements involved. It might be to remember who you were, that you were in this place and with your friends, and blah, 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 blah. That's another story. But purely in terms of creating an image, creating art, probably most photographs that are taken are just an attempt to replicate an idealized image that in most instances fails to achieve that. Now, when you listen to someone like Cartier-Bresson, and as you must be picking up, he's probably my most, the photographer who's been most influential in my own work. I assume everyone has heard of Henri Cartier-Bresson. Curiously, actually, he was a Buddhist. In the last years of his life, he actually took lots of photographs of young Tibetan reincarnate lamas. Very, very beautiful photos. And he spent, he was very much part of a Buddhist community in Paris. And for him, I think even before then, his photography was not just a mechanical exercise of producing images, but, as I'll quote to you now, something far more than that. This is Cartier-Bresson. He says, to take photographs is to hold one's breath when all faculties converge in the face of fleeing reality. It is putting one's head, one's eyes, and one's heart on the same axis. It is a way of freeing oneself, not of proving or asserting one's originality. It is a way of life. Now, this was written, I found this in a catalogue of an exhibition I went to see of Cartier-Bresson just before I went to India in 1972. So it was a show in the Hayward Gallery. And this passage, which was just about a page of text, handwritten, had an enormous impact on me and still does. And again, it's not hard to see when I read out that passage that Cartier-Bresson could just as well have been talking about meditation. Holding one's breath when all faculties converge in the face of fleeing reality. Putting one's head, one's eyes, and one's heart on the same axis. Freeing oneself. A way of life. And then later in the text, he says, the camera is an instrument of intuition and spontaneity. Which is probably the very opposite of what we might think of any kind of technical instrument. We see it as a recording device. Probably not as an instrument of intuition and spontaneity. So, again, we can see some parallels here with meditation or contemplative practice. That both meditation and photography demand a commitment and discipline and also a certain level of technical skill. Now, the technical skill element in meditation, I fear, is often given such importance that it takes over the whole picture. And we think that we would be good meditators if we could concentrate better or be more mindful or have a much better posture. We see it sometimes as literally training ourselves, developing ourselves in such a way that we become more concentrated, we become more focused, and in some ways we begin to mirror or model the ideals that we have of the good meditator, let's say the Buddha sitting beneath the tree. We're trying to approximate that ideal in the same way that when we take a photograph, we're often trying to approximate or achieve some idealized image. Now, I think both in photography or in any kind of art practice and in meditation, we clearly need to accomplish certain what we could call technical tasks. In other words, we can train ourselves to become more concentrated, for example. We can do certain exercises, go on retreats, receive instruction and teaching, and over time, instead of having a very scattered, vague, wandering mind, we have a more focused, attentive, perhaps even in some cases a deeply absorbed, jhanic experience in which concentration becomes total, almost. So clearly there are elements of meditation practice that we can learn and that we can develop and we can get good at. But the question then has to be asked, well, so what? Okay, I can concentrate deeply for 45 minutes. Why is that so important? Is it anything more significant than being able to master the technicalities of the latest Canon camera? Yeah, we're very good at it. But it seems that we have to differentiate between those elements of meditation that are of a purely technical nature and those elements of meditation that transcend technical proficiency and achievement. Much in the same way that one can learn photography, become completely fluent in the use of the camera, but fail to produce any photograph that would either satisfy oneself or others. And I think the same is true with meditation. We can get good at it and yet somehow still miss the point. If we put it in more, let's say, in the language of the virtues that Buddhism and other traditions value more deeply, can we arrive at a state of wisdom, a state of love, a state of understanding and empathy, just by training ourselves in certain meditative skills? I don't think so. I think something else is needed. And as we may also be aware, I notice this a lot, I meet people in the course of my daily life who often appear to embody the virtues I aspire to in a way that I find quite humbling, and yet they've not done any of the long retreats that I've ever suffered or studied Buddhism for donkey's years. They just seem to have a natural wisdom, a compassion, a kindness, an openness. So I think there's always this tension, whether it be in photography, whether it be in meditation, between the need on the one hand to achieve certain technical skills, but on the other hand, to have internalized those technical skills to the point that they can serve a higher value or purpose. They can generate great art, or the equivalent would be that they lead us to a frame of mind, a sensibility on life in which qualities such as understanding and wisdom and love begin to become more prominent. I think another thing that we can see, or at least I've seen, in both of these pursuits of photography and meditation, is that I started out, both in terms of what I wanted to photograph, as well as what I wanted to experience in meditation, with some idea of something extraordinary. That the best objects of photography would be the most unusual things I'd find in the most exotic and foreign landscapes. In other words, I felt that the photograph was very much dependent upon finding some extraordinarily special object or landscape or whatever it might be. And likewise in meditation, for a long time, I felt that the purpose of meditation was to get to some non-ordinary state of consciousness in which I gained some insight or understanding of something completely transcendent, some ultimate truth, some absolute reality that is somehow veiled from me by my confusions and delusions and attachments and so on. But in both cases, I've come to currently believe that the quest for the extraordinary or for the mystical is replaced by a rediscovery of the ordinary. And in fact, some of the most satisfying photographs that I've taken recently are actually of objects that I see every day. Ordinary things. And yet, seen in a way that somehow undermines their ordinariness, or let's say highlights the ordinariness so that the ordinary becomes extraordinary. In the same way with meditation, I'm really not interested whatsoever in gaining some deep transcendent insight into the nature of absolute reality, or God, whatever we might call it, but rather to be able to be far more open and appreciative and even overwhelmed by the ordinary, by what I experience in my body, my thoughts, my feelings, perceptions, my consciousness, what I see and hear and smell and taste and touch on a moment-to-moment basis. That the practice of both these disciplines is a practice that leads to a rediscovery of the obvious, a re-engagement with everyday life, not with something outside or beyond or behind everyday life. And I think this is an experience people have quite commonly on a retreat, for example, is that we find that, say, after two or three days of just trying to settle the attention on the breath, of becoming a little bit stiller inside, becoming less caught up in the entanglements of our thoughts and fantasies, that as the mind becomes more still, becomes more quiet, as we become somehow more accepting of ourselves and what's going on, that when we leave the meditation hall, say, and go outside into the garden, say, Gaia House, very often there are moments in which we're suddenly struck, sometimes blown away, by the way the leaves are moving on the tree, or the way the grass is shimmering in the evening light. In other words, the objects that we previously would have given no attention to whatsoever suddenly become infused with a kind of radiance, with a kind of beauty, with a kind of sublimity, in the sense that they kind of stop the mind. That even the most everyday thing can bring us to a state where the mind realizes that there's no way that I can capture that in a thought or a word or a concept or an idea. That the world is revealed to us somehow as excessive. As the Beatles used to sing, it's all too much. It is too much, and yet, and here we come back to what I was talking about this morning. For the most part, the world is not too much, it's not enough. It's lacking in something, it's dull, it's opaque, it's boring. And what I found through meditation and what I found through photography is by sustained, radical, deep attention, a visceral attention, as I mentioned this morning, we begin to find a way back into the lives that are with us all the time, and yet we've somehow become immured to. We've become somehow anaesthetized to experience. We find that our daily lives are very dull and boring. We've lost that innocence, in a way, of the young child. We've lost that capacity for wonder. And I think there's all kinds of factors at work here. I think one of the crucial ones is the sheer imperative of biological survival that constantly primes us and drives us to achieve security and status and wealth and comfort and so forth and so on. And even though that's, you know, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with that, a side effect of it is it renders our world less mysterious. We begin to interact with life in the world in terms of commodities that we can possess, in terms of things we can own and hold on to, etc., etc. We see things in terms of gratification of our egotistic needs for recognition and so on. And the side effect of that is that we lose the capacity to attend to life in an immediate, visceral and astonished way. I mean, a really good photograph to me is always, it always astonishes me somehow. The simple scene that I probably would have passed by a million times can be captured with a photographer with a good eye in a way that reveals it as something far more than just the everyday dull landscape that I pass by on my way to work. So how does this in any way connect to what Buddhism calls the Four Noble Truths? I think that what I've been trying to describe is in effect another way of talking about the process of practice that is encoded and embedded in the doctrine of the Four Noble Truths. Now, I'm sure all of you, if you've read anything about Buddhism or heard any talk on the Dharma, will be familiar with the Four Noble Truths. In fact, to the point where you probably have heard that so often, you find it completely uninteresting. And if someone were to say, I'm now going to give a talk on the Four Noble Truths, you would inwardly yawn. Now, part of the problem, I feel, is that the Four Noble Truths have basically become four propositions that we are expected to believe if we are to be considered Buddhists. And that's the way they're presented. In pretty much every book you open on Buddhism and you see a presentation of the Four Noble Truths, you'll be presented with four statements. The first statement is something like, existence is unsatisfactory, or life is suffering. The second statement will be something like, a craving is the cause or the origin of suffering. And the third statement will be that the cessation of craving is the cessation of suffering. And the fourth statement will be the practice of the Noble Eightfold Path is what leads to the ending of suffering. That standard Buddhist orthodoxy that you'll find in all the schools of Buddhism. But what we have, in fact, are four metaphysical propositions, four statements that Buddhists claim to be true, hence noble truths. They're noble because either by understanding them you will be ennobled, or there's something intrinsically good and valuable about these particular beliefs. But what that presentation is telling you implicitly is that Buddhism is founded on a set of beliefs in propositions that are regarded as true. And the practice, or let's say the commitment to being a Buddhist, is a commitment to holding those statements as truths. But not only is that reading problematic in terms of the Buddha's own presentation of the four, as I would call them, but also recent scholarship has shown that the term noble truth was almost certainly added late. You can see this on philological grounds, that at some point after the first teaching the Buddha gave on the four, some later monks probably inserted, not terribly skillfully, the term noble truth. And if you analyse the text from a technical point of view, you can, as it were, see the join marks where these have been slipped in. So we can question even that Buddhism is really about arriving at the truth or truths, but rather is concerned not with demonstrating or proving or realizing that these statements are true, but rather to consider that the whole process being described here has nothing whatsoever to do with arriving at the truth. It has to do with performing certain tasks that might make a felt difference in the quality of our experience. We don't have time to go into a detailed study of this, but if you read the Buddha's first discourse called The Turning of the Wheel of Dhamma, it's a short text of a couple of pages long, you'll see that in the conclusion of the text, the Buddha declares very clearly that he could only consider himself to be awake or enlightened when he had his knowledge and vision were entirely clear about the 12 aspects of the four. Again, that's a bit technical, but what it means, and the text shows this very clearly, is that each of these so-called truths is in fact a task to be recognized, to be performed, and to be accomplished. And that's why you get 12 aspects. Four truths times three. Recognition, performance, accomplishment. Now, when you think of them in this way, they boil down to four injunctions, or let's say suggestions, to make it a little less harsh, rather than four truth claims. And the first injunction is embrace suffering, or literally fully know suffering. The second injunction is let go of craving, let go of grasping. The third injunction is experience moments in which that grasping stops. And the fourth injunction is create and cultivate a way of life. Now, this is a very different way to thinking about this core Buddhist doctrine. It's turning it from truth claims that support an orthodox position as a Buddhist into challenges that we can rise to or not at any given moment. So rather than life is suffering, and again a huge amount of ink has been spilled trying to explain why that's the case, in spite of many counter-examples, like people are actually happy sometimes. And then the Buddhist riposte is, well, they're not really happy. Not until they've understood nirvana. But in other words, the very fact of giving you statements to believe sets up this kind of theological attempt to justify that these are in fact true. But we can drop all of that. It really doesn't matter. If we think of the first of the four as a task, namely dukkha parinya, embrace dukkha, then that means whenever a situation in life is before us, our challenge is to embrace it rather than shy away from it or to slip into aversion or attraction towards it. And you can perhaps begin to see where the photography is coming in now. This, of course, is the first step in photography. See what's there before your eyes without giving in to particular desires or particular ways to manipulate that image, but just be there with what you see. Embrace dukkha. And the next step is not to try to convince yourself that craving is the cause of suffering, which is a very difficult thing to demonstrate, in fact. I mean, old age, for example, is described as one aspect of suffering, but how is craving the cause of old age, for example? To make sense of that, you have to go into a quite convoluted theological argumentation. But if instead of thinking of it in that way, we simply say whenever a craving, a grasping, a fear, an aversion, an attachment arises, the challenge is not to give in to it, is to let go of it, is to find a freedom from that impulse. That doesn't mean you suppress it, but as we do in meditation, we simply notice it arise. We're fully aware of what our reactive patterns and desires and fears are, but we realize that we are not obliged or bound to follow them. That there's a freedom already there, as long and as soon as we start noticing our habitual reactive patterns. So if we go back to the photography analogy, this would be letting go of the attempt to produce a sub Henri Cartier-Bresson image, or letting go of the desire to capture the beautiful sunset. And again, these two work hand in hand. The more we pay close attention to what's going on with a visceral, deep, attentive awareness, the more we see through the absurdity, in a way, of our habitual desires to impose our will on what is occurring. And as we pursue this process, in other words, fully knowing and embracing our condition, which is basically what dukkha means, in letting go, or not, in a sense, getting entangled in our habitual reactions, we reach moments in which we stop, in which we find a kind of clarity, a sensitivity, an openness to what's going on, at which point we can respond to the situation in ways that we may not have imagined before. We're no longer determined in our thinking and our actions by our desires, our hatreds, our confusions, our fears. We open up to the possibility of responding in a non-hateful, non-fearful, non-grasping kind of way. And those moments are what Cartier-Bresson, in another context, called the decisive moments. The moments at which we choose to think or speak or act in a way that we had not envisaged before, in a way that's not determined or conditioned by the habits of our biology, the habits of our culture, of our religion, of our society, of our parents. But we find our own voice, we find our own way of being in the world, in which we discover our own authenticity. Again, authenticity is one of these words that is thrown around a lot. But in German, at least, it suggests that for something to be authentic means that it's something that's become very much your own. Das eigentlich, das eigene, one's own. In other words, a life that's lived from this perspective is one that has become, as the Buddha put it in the Pali Canon, aparapachaya, independent of others. And the person who has become a stream entrant, someone who's entered the Eightfold Path in an authentic way, is one who has become independent of others in the Buddha's teaching. So here we have, I feel, a process that parallels the process of photography, or photography in the way that one might envisage it as a form of art, namely to fully know what's in front of you, to let go of influences, desires, etc., that get in the way of seeing that clearly, arriving at a point at which you can stop and either press the shutter or in life say, think or act in another way that brings into being, in the case of photography, an image, another way of seeing the world that you hadn't considered before, or in life a thought, an act, a response, a gesture, whatever it might be, that has broken free of the cycle of repetitive habitual behavior. And that is called, in Buddhist jargon, entering the stream, which is again a very, I think, life-affirming image. A stream is, of course, flowing water. And the aim of the four tasks is to, as it were, dive into fully the stream of life itself, instead of always sort of hesitating and standing back on the edge of the stream and not quite having the nerve to jump in, and preferring instead to stay with the veil of the familiar. In other words, things that you think you know about yourself, about others. It's much more comfortable, but it's also at another level deeply disappointing. We somehow feel that we're not really living life to the full, whereas I feel that these four tasks, embracing dukkha, letting go of grasping, experiencing moments of stopping, and then acting, creating a way of life through one's words and one's deeds, this is very much about living a more flourishing human life. Now, I could go on and on, but I'm not going to. But I think what it points to is that the process of this path is a creative one. It's one in which we exercise the imagination. It's a practice that calls upon us in each moment, each day of our lives, to risk behaving in ways that might surprise us, that might surprise others, that might actually, perhaps just in tiny ways in the context of our family or our work, begin to open up other possibilities, begin to give voice to other values, rather than just going along with the habitual course of what we're used to and what seems somehow safe and familiar. So I'll leave that there, and it's now 2:45. Let's go outside. It's getting a bit stuffy in here. Let's do 30 minutes of walking meditation.